Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This variant is insubordinate, stubborn, unpredictable.
You need the God of Mischief.
Unbelievable. Wherever you go, it's just death, destruction, the literal ends of worlds.
Okay. Change. Change. Maybe Loki wants to mix it up. Is that possible? Can change.
I am Loki, and I am burdened with glorious purpose.
Change.
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching Loki for episode 4. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson. Something has happened to Richard Lawson this week. He has been zapped into potentially some alternative dimension.
Joe, we got to level with the people. Richard was a variant, and he had to be proved.
He had to go. Richard's been zapped away.
We have Kid Richard and Lizard Richard who will be joining us.
Richard might be gone for the rest of the season because he's off to Cannes, and we're unsure if we can make sort of the international schedule work out. So we might have lost Richard, but we have gained even more Anthony Breznican. So yes. that is a true joy for me. Hello, Anthony Breznican. How are you?
Oh, good. I jumped in even before I was introduced. Hey, everybody. But yeah, it's good to be with you, Joe.
So usually what we do on this podcast is what Richard and I pick a show. We break it down every week. We get a little nerdy about it, a little granular about it. And then Anthony comes at the end to get even nerdier and comic book and all that sort of stuff. But yeah. Anthony can wear all the hats. So basically we're gonna have that first section where we talk about sort of the series as a whole, maybe some sort of bigger how it fits in like the TV landscape questions. And then we're gonna take a break. We've got an interview, great long, juicy interview with series director Kate Herron, which you'll hear in the middle of the episode. And then Anthony we'll be back. We'll be back again to talk a little bit more about some forward-looking stuff, some theories, some comic book stuff. So that is how the show is going to run today. We're going to pepper in some emails. Stillwatchingpod@gmail.com is where you can find us. We got a bunch of great episode four emails today because you and I are recording a little later, Anthony, and because I put a call out on Twitter, we got a bunch of like episode four emails. So we will talk about them, but I want to start with you at the end of the episode, and I just want to tell everyone listening, if you haven't watched episode 4 yet, The Nexus Event, directed by Kate Herron, written by Eric Martin. You're going to want to go do that, and you're going to make sure you watch the mid-credits sequence, because that is very vital, and that is what we're going to talk about right now. So if you haven't watched it yet, if you're like, oh, there was a mid-credits, go watch it. Press pause, go watch it, and then come back, and that's what we're going to talk about.
We'll wait for you. Time has no meaning.
At the podcast VA. All right, so ready? Are we ready? Here we go. We're going to talk about it now. All right. So I just want to say, Anthony, that when first Mobius got zapped and then Loki, I was like, yeah, no way these guys are dead. Like, no way. No way, not in a million years. Like, maybe Mobius, but I was like, I don't think so. And so I got a little frosty as the credits roll, because I was like, are they going to try to do a fake out death for a week, because that's going to make me really mad if Tom Hiddleston has to like go around and like pretend that he's no longer on the show.
Yeah, guys, it was a good run, but you know.
That stuff just really bothers me. And then they gave us the mid-credits, and I was like, oh, phew, thank goodness, like we don't have to deal with that. So Anthony, can you describe what we see in the mid-credits sequence here in Loki episode 4?
Kind of a Lost vibe. Didn't it remind you of a little bit of Jack
in
waking up on the island?
Sure, I can feel it.
So Loki wakes up, and there's no Mobius, but he hears a voice saying, you know, essentially another movie reference, Terminator 2, come with us. And he looks up, and there's Kid Loki, and what is being called old Loki, if you're salty, classic Loki, if you're feeling generous, but it's Richard E. Grant in a kind of a baggy but comic book adherent costume.
The original Loki costume.
Yeah, the yellow and green, the bright yellow and green. And then we have Diobio Opari as what I guess we're calling Boastful Loki, right?
That's what the credits called him. Yeah.
That's what the credits call him, Boastful Loki. But he's got an interesting, like, hammer, and the hammer looks like part of an iron bar that you would have, like, in construction. That's what it looked like to me. I'm not quite sure what those things were that were on the top of it. I got to pause and freeze frame and zoom in, rotate 360 degrees. But there's a fourth Loki, which I believe Esquire did an expose on today. Is it Crocodile Loki or Alligator Loki? And I think they settled on Alligator Loki.
Yeah, I like Gator Loki, but I've heard Croc, Gator, Lizard Loki. At any rate, this is a non-humanoid Loki.
Reptilian Loki.
That's
where we're safe. And did you notice the background?
Oh, like, I sure did.
So
sure
that's did. Avengers Tower, right?
Yeah, in ruins.
Ruins. So New York City and Avengers Tower just decimated, and these four offbeat Lokis. It's like, I have to say that Yobia was the only one who looked like he, and maybe Kid Loki was the only one who could handle himself. The other two looked like they were lost. But
classic Loki. It's funny because Richard Grant has like sort of assumed this kind of crouching position, but that's how Loki was drawn, like at the beginning, in this weird like sort of bent over crouch sort of position, and that like baggy little uniform on him. Yeah. So
and what's Kid Loki, the actor's name?
Jack Beal. And like, we knew he was coming. Like, that kid has been posting on his Instagram account, like they let him say like he was in Loki, so you know, we knew this was coming. He's got the little original Avengers Loki hair flip, like the flipped Loki hair that we got from the first Avengers movie. The hammer that Boastful Loki has looks like, someone pointed out that it looks like parts of a railroad tie like a railroad track, and that the handle kind of looks like a part of the piston of a steam engine.
Oh, that's kind of neat.
I'm like, is this steampunk Loki? Like, I would be into that. But the bottom line is, like, what we've learned is that when you get pruned, you don't necessarily die. You get dumped in, like, a pocket dimension. Does everyone get dumped in the same pocket dimension? Or is there, like, just one pocket dimension for Lokis and one pocket, like, is Mobius in a pocket dimension with, like, a bunch of Owen Wilson's, like, that would be really fun. But the point being is we have a league of Lokis now, and they are going to try to, you know, do what Lokis do, escape. And I've got some big thoughts on that, which we'll get to after later in the episode, based on some trailer shots. But yeah, it's exciting to see this. I'm happy to see Kid Loki. He's here. You and I read some Kid Loki comics in preparation, so that's really fun. And it does kind of blow a hole in my big idea that Richard E. Grant was, like, behind everything at the TVA. Instead, it just seems like we're just going to get, like, classic Loki, which is fun. I'm not mad about it. I'm here for it. So yeah, the other, you mentioned Lost, and that's a good comparison. The other one that I was thinking of is that it's a lot like that shot at the end of the Avengers, all the Avengers gathered around Loki that we saw in episode one of Loki, right? Where, like, it's Hawkeye and Black Widow and Thor and Cap and Iron Man all looking down at Loki.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
Yeah. So it's a bunch of Lokis instead, which is fun. So here they come. The League of Lokis.
That's a good callback, Joanna. Really good. Sharp eye.
I think it means that Mobius isn't dead. I think he's just been dumped somewhere, you know.
He got a nice departure there, and but there's still more to come from him. I'm absolutely certain.
I wanted to revisit. This is something I was planning to do with Richard. So this is not based on your opinion of episode three, but I wanted to revisit this, like, critique of episode three that it was like a filler episode, and I want to you know, you weren't a big fan of episode three. I have heard from a number of other people who weren't a big fan of episode three, and they had critiques that I, like yours, that I found really reasonable. So really, I'm just addressing, like, a more unreasonable critique, not your more nuanced take on it, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Can I just say something?
Of course.
Like, I was really depressed to see that people were hating on the episode for bad reasons, and, like, if I had known that, I probably would have modulated my feelings a little more. I just didn't realize that, I don't dislike the episode as filler. There were just aspects of the story that I felt didn't work.
So, yeah, exactly.
Usually I'm much more upbeat about things,
You don't have to apologize.
Sorry, guys. From now on, it's all upbeat.
No. You have nothing to apologize for. But, like, this question of, like, an episode being a filler episode, that was the complaint, that, like, nothing happened, quote unquote, in that episode. But, like, for whatever your critique of that episode might be, what they needed to do and what they were trying to do in that episode is form a bond between these two Loki. In a way that, like, we find out in this episode is not even, like, a platonic camaraderie, but, like, a bona fide romantic spark between these two. That seems like it's going to be plot significant when they, like, if a mere forearm graze can send a Nexus event shooting up off the sacred timeline, what could anything else do? Do you know what I mean? Between these two. So that's what they were, your mileage may vary about whether or not they were successful. They successfully wrapped that emotional connection into a plot that worked for you. But I think it was important to take an episode just to build those emotions so that when Mobius lies to Loki and says she's dead, like, and Tom Hiddleston has this reaction that feels, earned in that moment.
Exactly. I think the opening of this most recent episode, nothing happens. They're sitting there waiting for their doom to strike, and their doom to arrive, their deaths to come, and they're just sitting on rocks. And I thought there was a lot of character development there, and I thought it was really beautiful. And there definitely was some in the previous episode. I think maybe it was just the other stuff they had to dress it up. Those are the parts that I thought just.
I have to wonder, like, because, and I mentioned this to you last week, because the episode ends so abruptly last week, and the runtime was a little shorter. I have to wonder if there was a cut of that episode that ends with those two doors appearing and them standing up. That felt like, and then it cuts to them at the TVA. Like, that felt like the start of the next episode.
Yeah, I agree. Like, so, the slow-mo perp walk as they're going through the hall felt like the way episode 4 probably was supposed to start.
So I don't know why they I don't know this for certain, but it seems like that's the case, and I don't know why they would have shifted that end there. Maybe they just wanted to keep it like just Loki and Sylvie and not like involve the TVA or whatever, but
well, you could have ended it with just the doors opening, because we don't even see them go through.
Yeah, but you have, I mean, like, what we that's what I mean. Like, I think it should have ended with the doors opening and with that moment, like, because something you said you were missing in episode 3 was like our Loki is giving her so much and she's giving him nothing. And I thought that was appropriate because, you know, she has no reason to trust him. But then at the moment that she thinks she's going to die, then she opens up to him. And then we get that sort of bond. And I think that could have existed all in the same episode.
I agree. And I think I would have liked that more. You know, my issue is not to relitigate it. It was just like I think the action that they built into it didn't hold up for me and didn't interest me as much. And that's as far as it goes. Otherwise, I respect a lot of what the episode did and what it did accomplish. And I hate it, you know.
You are not on trial here at all.
Like, I shot my television like Elvis Presley.
You're not on trial, Anthony.
I was just like, oh, all right, you know. And I think you're right. There is a lot that paid off in those moments where before the doors opened and he did have to, you know, he had to get his 48 hours in with Lady Loki. You know, you have the two mismatched teammates who don't really like each other and don't trust each other, and they go through some ordeals, and then they do and kind of prove themselves to each other. So I like the episode for that, and I feel like it did help support episode 4 in a really profound way.
What we get in that moment is we find out sort of or what we get in this episode is we find out about young Sylvie coming into the TVA and, you know, under the care of Ravonna in her Minutemen days and her fear, just this fear for this child sent through this whole process that we already saw. Like, it was funny when Loki went through it, right? And then we see this young girl, this young terrified girl go through it. And, like, her fear at the, like, robot detector and, like, all of that stuff is just, like, you know, obviously it casts the TVA in a really sinister light, but it's showing us the origin of, like, this great wound that's inflicted on her. She's ripped from her home at Asgard and put through all of this. And I thought that was really effective. What did you think?
I thought it was really sad, and it makes the TVA look horrible. You know, they look cruel. And especially later when she's like, what was the thing that we did what did I do that stepped outside of the bounds that made you decide to come erase me? And Ravonna says, I don't even remember. Do you think she's lying?
I think she's lying. Yeah. Ravonna lies a lot is what we find out.
Yeah, that's true.
But, I read an interesting theory, about that, and I'm so sorry, I don't know the exact source on it, but I read it from one of our listeners from another source. Because there is a big question of, like, what was the Nexus event for Sylvie? Because it wasn't her birth. It wasn't just being born a girl. Like, that, you know, otherwise they would have zapped her as an infant, right? So it was something that happened when she was young. And someone came with a really good idea that we see her playing with some toys before she's taken. And there's, like, a Viking ship, a giant wolf, a dragon, and a Valkyrie. And she's, like, depicting the Valkyrie defeating the dragon is what's happening. And so someone's idea was, like, what if it's that in that moment she's making a choice to be, like, a heroic Loki rather than, like, a scheming Loki? Because the question that keeps coming up, when I talk to Kate, you'll hear Kate talk about this in our interview, and when I talked to Woonmi last week, is this idea of, like, if there is someone out there pruning timelines, do you have any control over whether you're or not you're a good person? If someone is pruning all other opportunities for you to make the better choice, if someone needs you to be the villain, and I kind of feel like maybe that's what we're headed towards with Loki. It's like, whoever's behind the TVA, and we'll talk about that in a bit, like maybe they need Loki to be the villain, and maybe these various Lokis, like whoever boastful Loki is, he's worthy of a hammer. You know what I mean? Like maybe these are the Lokis who made better decisions, and that's not the Loki that the sacred timeline wants or needs. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah. What did reptile Loki do to
Well, yeah. And so maybe like young Sylvie, like she was on the path to be a hero. And the TVA is like, no,
nope.
We need Loki to be our villain. And that's really heady stuff, right? You didn't even have a shot as a Loki to be a hero. You always had to be their villain. I'll be their monster, sort of thing. We go from Sylvie's later in the episode when Loki gets stuck in this little looping time prison with a cameo from Jamie Alexander's Lady Sif. It's not that Loki's greatest fear or greatest punishment is being cracked in the nethers by Jamie Alexander, though that couldn't have been pleasant. It's what she says, right? Which is, you'll always be alone. And so then we get to zero in on Loki's biggest fear is this isolation and loneliness. Well, like how did that land with you? Like, what do you think the show is trying to tell us or trying to ask us to think about in terms of Loki here?
Yeah, I go back to the Neil Young song that I mentioned that maybe a couple episodes back. He tried to do his best, but he could not. And I think this is about Loki, who ultimately has to live with himself. And I really believe this in real life, that you can't be a good friend, you can't be a good partner to somebody else or a good parent unless you feel that you can live with yourself first. Right, that you feel that you're comfortable as yourself. You don't have anything to give anyone else if you are, unless you have that steadiness,
right?
You know,
the prophet RuPaul, if you can't love yourself, how the hell are you gonna love someone else? Go ahead. Yeah,
that's right. I like that. That's a good quote from RuPaul. Which is not to say that people who are unsteady or who have struggles, or you know, are unresolved, difficulties are bad people. It's you're a person in need of help, and hopefully you have people who love you who will provide that help. But that's what I mean is those people have to, you know, if you're going to care for somebody who's ailing, let's say, or has a just challenges of whatever sort, it helps when you just have that solidness about you, you know. And I think he's trying to find that. I think we get villainous Loki because he's insecure and he's angry and unstable. And what happens when he's not? He has something else to offer the world. And so I think that's kind of what we're seeing. This whole notion of you're alone, I think he's going to find that being alone is actually the thing he needs most of all. It may be what he fears most of all, but it's what he needs. And you and I have talked endlessly about how Marvel creates affection for its characters through the people they love and care about, you know? And I think it's ironic to say, but, you know, because there's such a, you know, narcissism is like one of the badges that Loki wears on his sleeve. But I think loving who he is and feeling like he's a good person or feel a good demigod or feeling like he has something to contribute rather than just something to destroy is an important aspect of who he is. And I think once he achieves that, I think that's why you see that, maybe that's why you see that variant thread, that Nexus event spiking so heavily. It's not necessarily the touch or the romantic touch between the Lokis, but the notion that they're offering each other support.
Yeah.
They're being good guys.
Well, I think it's both. Mm-hmm. I think it's both. I think because like Marvel.com had a piece that went up today with like Waldron and Kate Herron and Tom and et cetera talking about this, like, this absolutely is a romance that that Michael Waldron, his initial pitch was like a Loki falls in love with another Loki, like, and he sort of implied that that might be coming. He said in his big interview that he gave us for the website, like, that he just wants to be Nora Ephron. That's what he wants to be. Like, this is a romance. And, like, what's funny is you'll hear, I talked to Kate Herron for this podcast last Friday. I asked about the romance. She kind of said no. So that's going to maybe flavor how you interpret maybe anything else that Kate says to me, because, you know, they're trying to protect their plot turns or whatever. I think there may be what might have been a way for her to answer that question without it being quite so untrue. But I know that they're sort of, they got their hands tied on some things. So it's definitely a romance. Like, and this idea, what I love about this idea is, you know, Mobius says something about, like, whatever it is you guys did, like, I think it could bring this whole place down, right? Like, and you don't have a line like that if that's, you know, not going to be something that probably happens. Like,
yeah, yeah. If that's, like, foreshadowing for sure.
If a kiss takes down the TVA or whatever. But, like, you have to go back to what Loki said in episode 3, where he said love is a dagger. Like, if they're love for each other, and you can, you know, call it whatever you want, they're, but that bond is their greatest weapon. Love is a dagger. Love is a weapon. Love is a weapon that will protect us. Mm-hmm. Love is a weapon that will take down this thing that wants us to be villains when really we don't, that's not who we want to be, you know?
We could be heroes.
Just for one day, you know?
Yeah.
So,
all right. Can we take it into real world, sort of? Could you fall in love with a variant of yourself?
Like,
some people are like, I would like to be with another me. Like, somebody, you know, not exactly you, not a clone of you, but.
I don't know. I mean, like, so some people like to be with someone who's very different from them and challenges them. And for some people, it feels better to be with someone who thinks the way that you do, so that you don't feel like you have to explain yourself constantly. Do you know? And so I like this idea that Loki, our Loki, because we've been with him longer, is finally met someone who's not going to judge him for who he is. Like, we talked about similar things with Mobius, and Mobius, like, I know you're smart. You know what I mean? Like, this Loki, he doesn't have to prove his worthiness, which is what he was Odin is one of the crappiest dads in all the MCU, right? If not the crappiest. And, like, Loki having to constantly prove worthiness, this whole worthy crap that is running around Asgard, like, that is what has twisted him up. And so this meeting this woman who, like, he doesn't have to prove his worthiness to, you know, her. Like, she knows who he is. She knows even, like, his worst impulses. And he doesn't have to hide it or explain it or anything like that. I think there is something really attractive in that. Do I want it personally? I don't know. But, like, yeah, what do you think? What do you think?
I don't think so. I, like, my wife and I have been together a long time. And I think the best thing is that she's very different from me. And I feel like she opens up the world to me in a lot of ways that I might not see or might not understand. So I like somebody. I think I would. I would file for divorce instantly for myself. Wouldn't last. It would be like one of those Hollywood tabloid marriages that ends before it even the honeymoon's over. No, I don't think I could go for a variant. I'd be interested to meet a variant, but I don't know that I don't think we would get along too well.
The one thing I will say that I am not a big fan of is the way that episode 2 ends with this, like, bombing of the timeline, and it's this big deal, and when we cut to, like, the timeline's fine now, like, they fixed it off screen somewhere, and that's, like, that's a little it feels a little sloppy to me to make such a big deal about her bombing the timeline across time and space, and then it's just yada 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 fixed, I guess, off screen. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, you know, I agree. So don't hate me, folks. I think there's a couple of examples here where the big drama doesn't actually manifest as much. So I think that's a little bit of a problem.
Yeah, we got a couple emails about it. People are like, "What, you know, what happened with the whole bombing of the timeline?" And I'm like, "Yeah, it's, I mean, maybe it'll come back, but and I understand that it was more of a diversion than anything else. But like, we still saw it was like an all hands event at the TVA, and then everything is just reset back to normal, you know. So, let us talk about the awakening that we see for B-15 and for Mobius. B-15 a little bit more direct, Mobius a little bit more theoretical, but this is another place in which I'm like a little unsatisfied with the way that this played out in this episode. B-15 gave me a little like Tears in the Rain vibe, right? Because they're standing in the rain outside the rock
totally,
cart, and like,
yeah.
Is she crying? We can't know because it's Tears in the Rain. Who knows, Blade Runner? But I mean. One, Miyamasaki is so good and her performance is so good, but I think I wanted that moment to feel even bigger than it did. What did you think?
Okay, well, we have found a little bit of variance between us then, because I really loved that moment. And mm-hmm. I definitely had Blade Runner vibes coming off of it. But what I loved was we don't see what she sees. And you're right that might have made it bigger, but instead it all rested on Wunmi Masaku saying, "I was happy," and she says it in such a sad way.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That like, and she's such a tough character, B-15. Like she's all armored up and she looks really strong. It looks like she could throw you through a room. Like she looks like nobody you'd ever want to mess with. She seems so vulnerable. Like I just wanted to embrace her and comfort her. And it wasn't that she was sad. She was sad because she saw that she had been happy. She'd had a good life that was ended and taken away from her by the TVA. So, I just outstanding performance by Wunmi there.
She's fantastic. I think,
and I know you were not talking about her, but just sort of story-wise, but I liked it. I think we're going to learn more about her, and I was content once I just heard her description. You know what it reminded me of is, have you ever seen those videos of young kids who get the cochlear ear implant, and it's like, okay, we're going to turn it on, and their eyes get really big, and they hear their mother's voice for the first time, and they're just kind of overjoyed and kind of mind-blown by it. Like, that's what it reminded me of, but you don't hear what they're hearing, right? You just are observing their reaction. So it's sort of witnessing her awakening just externally by looking at her and seeing how she like sort of crumbled in a lot of ways was really moving, I thought.
How do you feel about Mobius not getting like a similar moment that he's just sort of like...
I think it's coming.
Working the case, but not... Okay.
I don't think he's dead.
I definitely don't think he's dead. I just, like, he seems to know the truth without having that moment where, like, he saw his life and all we got was, like, maybe I had a jet ski. And I'm like, do I need to see Owen Wilson on a jet ski? I'd prefer to, but, like, do I need to see that? No, but I feel like I needed a bigger moment for him because, like, he's processing it throughout this whole, like, as he's stealing Ravana's time pad, like, as he's doing all this sort of stuff, like, he's processing it, but we don't get that, like, maybe I'm spoiled by Westworld, where it's just, like, a big earth-shattering moment every time one of those, like, robots wakes up, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I would just draw a line between Hunter B-15, Mobius, and Kid Lady Loki, like, what we're seeing in each of these instances is the cruelty of the TVA.
Absolutely.
You know? And I think just allowing that to sit with the audience, it's positioning us against this entity, which we never really, nobody loves a bureaucracy to begin with, but it's kind of like, oh yeah, I guess we understand law and order, right? You've got to keep the peace, keep the timeline together. And now you start to see like, well, wait a minute, maybe these people who are keeping order are actually not being very fair about it. And maybe they're keeping their own order, right?
I think we were appropriately skeptical from the start on this podcast, but I do think that like it's in the course of the show, like the TVA is it's just like if you're looking at the propaganda on the walls. I'm not trusting those people from the start. But I think it is good for the show to go on that journey for these characters.
It makes you feel it. I mean, we kind of intuited that they were up to no good, but it makes you feel it.
Humanize.
We got a question from Rebecca who asked, how did young lady Loki know how to use that gadget to escape from the TVA when she'd been taken? I think, just sleight of hand. Like, it's the same thing that Loki's been doing. She just lifted it off Ravonna and ran with it. So.
And how did she know how to use it? It's pretty pretty lo-fi. When you looked at it, it looks like an old school Game Boy.
Yeah, the UI is really easy. Yeah.
It's like 8-bit.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty simple.
Yeah, but I like the fact, like, thinking about Sylvie on the run since she was that little, being alone and scared, and that goes back to what Mobius said about Loki. I just think of you, that scared little baby boy, like, you know what I mean? They're the same, and they found each other. I think it's really beautiful. All right, let us go to sort of this up the elevator moment. We got a Wizard of Oz moment. We got some Last Jedi throne room fight stuff happening.
I totally thought of the Last Jedi, too. I'm glad you mentioned it, because I was like, what? Am I picking this up?
Yeah. No, definitely. How do you feel about the fact that we, like, met the space lizards, and then immediately they were revealed as robots?
I feel really good about that, because I think this episode... It does a good job of matching what you and I have been proposing on here.
Sometimes.
I don't like when we're disproved. And so it's always better when we're right about everything. But, I think this shows the people that that we don't know everything in advance. We don't get we don't get clued in. We're not talking, ahead of ourselves. But I believe that we're going to see Kang the Conqueror and Jonathan Majors as that character. And so when he wasn't the center figure of that triumvirate, I was like, oh, damn.
Oh, no.
I thought all those carvings looked like him.
Yeah.
And then and I was like, I guess I was wrong about that, but then when they decapitated and it's great moments with Abe Lincoln, it's like Imagineering animatronic. I was like, okay, this is weird. Like, why do this? Like, why create this Chuck E. Cheese band for everybody to stand before? But, there's got to be a good reason for that, for these guys to stay in the shadows. And I think I'm eager to learn more about that. So I felt pretty good about it, just from a we were right standpoint. And I also felt pretty good about him saying, maybe where I'm from, I had a jet ski. Because I'm like, you're from the 90s, man. We're going to find that out for sure.
Yeah. The idea at this point that, like, and this is something that, Anthony and I have been talking about in the sort of more advanced section of the podcast, this idea that, like, perhaps the person behind all of this is a character called King the Conqueror. Who's this big villain in Marvel Comics, and who will be played by the actor Jonathan Majors in the upcoming Ant-Man film. And so that's been a popular theory. And then, like, last week at some point I was like, maybe it's a Loki behind the TVA, but I think we're swinging real hard back to Kang. How much we see him or whether or not we actually physically see him will be a question. But a reason that folks have been expecting Kang the Conqueror might be coming from the start is that the character of Ravonna Renslayer is his wife in the comics. And it's another reason why people have been a little wary of Ravonna because of her Kang associations in the comics. So, I mean, I think this episode bears out that she is, if not fully in the know of what's going on, at least complicit in what's going on. So here we go. We're off to the races. So I think that Joy wrote and asked what happened to B-15 and what happens is she comes in and she just gets knocked out. She's not dead. She's not pruned. She's, like, sort of knocked out, down for the count for a minute. So we'll see if she pops up to help.
Yeah,
Sylvie.
She's going to be back too, right?
Yeah. All right, is there anything else you want to talk about in this sort of like first section here before we move on?
I thought this was a pretty strong episode, and it's one that had a lot of Joanne Robinson favorited talking. You know, there wasn't, apart from the Last Jedi battle, there was, it was kind of light on action, so I really enjoyed the you know, the interpersonal aspects of it. I love the scenes between Ravonna and Mobius too, where he realizes she's lying to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how she keeps saying, "Oh, how strange you're behaving. You're being so odd." He's being actually reasonable for the first time, and I thought all of that was really cool. So I was moved by this episode. I was excited by it. I love the weird mysteries that it conjures, both with the post-credit scene and the animatronic timekeepers. Like, why do that? I thought the performances were all great. So I'm eager for episode 5.
All right, so let's go to our interview with Kate Herron. Like I said, Kate was sort of giving me some editorialized answers because she couldn't talk freely. But so bear that in mind when you hear her answers. Like, given the answer she gave me about the Loki-Sylvie romance, that makes me question the answer she gave me about Miss Minutes, which is something we could talk about in the post-interview section, because that is someone that people have their eye on. So let us go now to our interview with Kate Herron.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Hello. So good to see you. So good to talk to you. I wanted to start by asking you, how does it feel to finally sleep and be a sane person in the world again?
Yeah, it's weird because I'm, as I said, I'm back in my childhood bedroom. It's really nice to see my family again. It's so nice to just be back in England. Yeah, and just get, yeah, like you said, get some sleep because it's been nonstop for the last 2 years, pretty much, with Loki. So,
But what I really wanted to start by asking you was about Sophia, because I know that she's someone that you had worked with before. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, you know, what made her the person you want to slide into this role here?
So Sophia is someone that I just think is a really fantastic actor. You know, like I'd worked with her before in my short film Smear, and she'd also played a head for me in a horror pitch I was doing. We definitely knew each other and through comedy and filmmaking circles. And she just has this like fire and vulnerability, but she's also really funny, and it's just, it felt like so many different components about what I love about her as an actor are very Loki like so I was like, I just, when we were auditioning people, I was like, you know, let's just get her on tape because I just think she's really interesting, and I thought she was amazing in Flowers. And yeah, so no, I was really excited just to get her in and just kind of see her take on the character. So
what did you, I know that Michael called this sort of like the Before Sunrise episode, but like, what did you think of in terms of the dynamic between these two and what you wanted to capture?
I was really inspired by Bisha's script because I remember that Bisha, she had like Children and Men as a reference and Before Sunrise. And I was like, that's such an interesting combination to me, you know, to have these, there's such different references. And I loved it because it was like a character driven story. You know, and you can kind of see it in the way we filmed it, right? We've got these very long kind of two shots. So it has this kind of walking quality to it, Light Before Sunrise. And you feel like you're with them, but at the same time, it's in this Children of Men, like, you know, apocalyptic situation that they're in. So I think for me, what I was inspired by from those references was, you know, like, for example, like Pompeii in episode 2, like Loki is joyous and we see that situation completely through his POV. Mm-hmm. And obviously Pompeii, I imagine if you were there, was not joyous. It was right. probably very scary. And I think it was important, like we sort of start to tip it a little bit with Rock's car in that, you know, it's like these apocalypses are scary situations and this is real people here. You know, that when they go into the kind of the storeroom where the people are sheltering from the storm. And I think for me with this one, I was like, okay, well, I was really inspired by how Bisha had captured this kind of class society within the moon and just kind of giving that a reality, really. And I think for me, that was exciting. And also seeing this kind of apocalyptic scenario through our two characters' eyes, which obviously is very interesting because when they go to the train station, they are, you know, they're aware of what they're doing is terrible, but they're like, okay, well, we'll get on this train. But I think that's why it was so important by the time they reach Shuru, the city, that it is quite horrible and it is quite scary. So yeah, those were definitely like touchstones for me for sure.
What about like the specific dynamic between these two? Like, okay, let me put it this way. Am I supposed to be shipping Loki with Loki? How am I supposed to be feeling about this, Kate? Is this, am I watching a romance? What am I watching?
I think, honestly, I think the thing I'd say that you want to steer people in is more just that what would happen if you met someone who was a version of you but wasn't necessarily you, because, you know, she isn't the Loki we've seen. She's a completely unique character. And I think that was really important, was just that, you know, that she was like, there's things about her which would be familiar to us through having seen them through Tom's Loki. Mm-hmm. But then there are things about her that are completely different because her world experience is very different. I mean, I could even put that down to like their fighting styles, right? Like the way she fights is very rough and very ready, which we kind of, I wouldn't really say we explore why her fighting's that way, but we kind of explore more her background and why she is, you know, why she would fight like that. Whereas Loki grew up in a palace. So, you know, he's very balletic the way he moves.
Right.
So yeah,
right.
No, I would say more, it's the idea of, I think identity, it always comes back to identity for me. It's kind of like what would happen if you met this version of yourself, because I think we can sort of learn so much from ourselves.
To that end, you know, these are two Lokis as far as we know, like looking at each other, but what are we to make of Sylvie's deep aversion to the name Loki? Like what can you tell us about that at this point?
Her identity is something we definitely delve into as the show goes on, in terms of, like, you know, like, why is her hair blonde and why is she pushing away this view of, you know, who she was? So I think for me, like, I don't want to spoil anything, but I would just say that, yeah, like, she's definitely a very different version of the character, and someone like our Loki, I guess, in a sense, that's kind of working out who they are. So I think that's what was so exciting to me with Sylvie, is that, you know, this is a character that we find out in episode 2 is hiding in apocalypses, and the question is why, and yeah, what is her motive, like what drives her? And I think the thing I liked so much about ep 3 was them kind of sharing those bits of knowledge between them. And I think you get the sense, even when at the end he says, I know so much, you know, I told you so much about myself and I know not very much about you, and she's like, yeah, thanks. But I think that for me is so intriguing, because it's like, yeah, what does she have to share with him, and what was her journey, and what kind of Loki is she? So
right, the line in this in episode 3, what makes a Loki a Loki, that's like the thesis statement of the show, right? Like when you take away these other influences, what is at the core of a Loki?
Well, I had in my pitch on a slide, I remember I put that as like one of the, because I was like so excited by that, like intellectually. And yeah, and I think that's definitely something that me and the writers and like, yeah, the whole team is like, that's really like the central beating heart of the show is, yeah, what does make a Loki a Loki? And we kind of break that down.
Do you feel like we will know definitively by the end of 6 episodes what makes a Loki a Loki, or to be continued?
I think we definitely bring it to a point where I feel the story is satisfying, in the sense that, yeah, I think we do. I think it's tricky always, right, to always answer like what makes a person or a god in the sense of our story, because, you know, people, it's funny saying people, characters are ever evolving, You know what I mean? So like, we definitely, you know, our Loki definitely goes on like a amazing journey, I'd say, across this story. And I think there's a lot of, you know, self-reflection, and I think he will arrive to some answer to that question, but I don't really think it's ever a question you get an answer to, right? It's something you're always kind of working out.
Yeah, right. Hopefully, if you're a curious person, you are continually changing and evolving.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you a little bit about Owen then, like, you know, this hard pitch that you gave to Owen to sort of be on the show. Something that I thought was interesting, is this, you know, it was pointed out to me in interviews that one of the lines that really stood out for me in episode one, where he said, like, I can play the heavy keys too, is something that like Owen plucked from something Tom said to him about how, you know, Loki is. So I'm wondering, like, how collaborative or involved was Owen in crafting Mobius's dialogue as a writer himself?
Completely. Like, I mean, on set, it's like, you know, we have these great scripts, but, you know, the guys would improvise stuff within. I think the thing with Owen is it's almost like improv, right? Like he works out the rules of a scene and he'll do the written words, but then sometimes he'll just, you know, sprinkle in other bits and pieces or give a line a twist in his way of speaking. So like, for example, in the archives, when they're talking about candy, I think that scene originally ended being like on like, boom, kablooey. And like, but then Owen was like, you don't have candy on Asgard. And then Tom was just like, great, it's nuts. And he was like, oh, no wonder you're so bitter. But they improvised that whole bit. And I think for me, that was really fun. I mean, I'm always, as a director, I'm very actor driven. So I'm, and I guess because my background's in comedy. So I'm always going to be like, you know, obviously honoring what we've worked on with the writers, but at the same time, like, I think that's the joy, right, with filming, is that, you know, it's always evolving, it's always changing. You know, you go out with your script and but when you get to set, some things just change with the script, whether that be, you know, an act of God like rain or an actor being like, oh, could I maybe twist the line in this way? And then you get to the edit and it's almost like, not like you begin again, but it's again just always evolving and changing, because, you know, you're working out, okay, this is the next part of now telling this story. So yeah, but Owen was great. Like, he's a genius, and yeah, and he does have a writer's brain for sure. So he wasn't obviously like physically writing lines, but in the sense that, yeah, he was definitely like improvising and throwing things in left, right, and center, but always within, I'd say, like, keeping respect to the character. And yeah, there's lots of fun Owenisms across it. But yeah, but with the heavy keys, Tom has a way of describing Loki, which I love, which is he describes his personality as different keys on the piano. And when me and him were talking about the show, we would be like, oh, okay, well, maybe now we'll get to see some other keys on the piano, which is quite exciting. And I think something that Owen really loved about that, obviously, I think they kind of obviously spoke about Loki because he's meant to be a Loki expert. And he definitely took in that analogy. And yeah, and that's how it ended up in the show. But the other day, I remember Owen, I was talking to him on the phone, and he was like, you kept in a lot of the improv. And I was like, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I think there are plenty of directors or editors who might, you know, snip around that and keep cue close to the script. And so I like that you're like, no, we're gonna sprinkle those Owenisms all the way through if we can. That's so fun. What I mean, obviously we learned something huge in episode three that sort of, you know, has to realign the way that we think about Owen's character, Wunmi's character, Sasha's character, etc. This idea that they are like variants with their minds wiped, or something. You know, what can you say about what we should be thinking about around that revelation?
I would say that we will, more will come in answers. Everyone's like, sure. Damn you. But honestly, I think, again, it just comes back to that idea that everybody is not one thing in this show. It's always about, like, and I feel for me, that's so Loki. I feel like his DNA is across everything, in the sense that, you know, Loki isn't completely good or bad. He's a bit more gray area. And I think that also falls into, that echoes across all our characters. You know what I mean? And I think that's very interesting to me, the idea of good versus evil. And yeah, and what does that mean for the TVA? What does that mean for the workers if they don't know, you know, their true past? And it's obviously something we'll talk about. But yeah, but I would say more this, it kind of plays into those themes. And that's probably all I can say without ruining anything. But
sure. Yeah. But I mean, at the very least, it has to, you know, if we weren't already perturbed by the propaganda posters or, you know, the fascistic uniforms of the TVA, this wrinkle is very sinister feeling. Like, it's meant to feel sinister, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's safe. That's safe. We're not spoiling anything. Okay. So let me ask you this question. Okay, so yeah, so you brought up good versus evil. I want to talk to you about something that, like, Woonmi talked to me about last week. Was she was really interested in talking about these themes of good versus evil, on a very religious sort of sense of good versus evil. And obviously, like, you've introduced this theological language when it comes to, like, sacred timeline. We're dealing, you know, Loki keeps comparing the TVA to, like, the gods of Asgard, all this sort of stuff like that. I was wondering, you know, sort of how intentional were some of, I got a little too inside my head about this episode 3, and I was like, oh my god, they're at the gates, the pearly gates, and they get dropped down into, like, a hellscape, and then someone calls them devils. Like, is that, how intentional is all of that? How are you thinking about this as, like, you know, how biblical should we be thinking here?
I think it's definitely something that me and the writers were interested in. I mean, it's even like in episode 1, right? Which, you know, Michael, like the first episode, like the devil in the window. I mean, for me, like, I thought, you know, on one level that's interesting because, you know, Loki has horns and it's connected to Loki in that way. But I loved it because I was like, yeah, he is, like, you know, in a way, like the devil, like he fell from heaven and was cast out. And I think there's definitely, we have imagery across it. And, you know, we were so, it's definitely something that I was interested in terms of, you know, like their discussion in the cafeteria, like talking. I mean, I love that scene because to me, it feels so relatable. It's like two people, completely different religious backgrounds, but it's not like they're going at each other and being hateful towards each other. They're just kind of being like, yeah, like, this is what I believe. I know it sounds weird, but this is what I believe. And that felt very relatable to me, just, you know, in seeing people kind of discuss that. So I think, yeah, there's definitely imagery of that running across it. Yeah, I would say, yeah, there is definitely.
I know you talked about Seven as an influence, and I loved, like, I think my favorite game that, it's weird to talk about it as a game, but my favorite game that I've played in the season is, you said there's a Seven Easter egg in episode 2. You said that in an interview, and then I was like, oh, I'm gonna find it. And then I found the music cue, and I was like so proud of myself that I found it. But, like, I think in that interview you said that there was, like, you know, bigger sort of Seven inspiration for you. Like, how big is the, because Seven is also a story that's very occupied with this idea of good versus evil, biblical good, biblical evil. Like, how much should we be sort of thinking, having that in mind as we're watching this?
I would say, like, I mean, you summarized it so nicely, but I would say definitely, like, the idea of good versus evil. Are we completely good or are we completely bad? Can we move past, you know, terrible past actions? I mean, this falls into our Loki already. You know, wasn't so long ago he was in New York, so
right.
But it is like a ripple effect across everything in our story, and I think it is something where we want to definitely challenge the audience in some ways to, you know, question that within the characters themselves. It's like kind of what you said. It's like, oh, but how do I feel about this character now I have this information? So I think that it's definitely a ripple effect across the whole show. I would say, though, honestly, the biggest reference for me was Seven. But definitely thematically, of course, that falls into it, was really stylistically in terms of, like, me and my DP, because basically when I pitched on the show, I had like an outline of it and I had the first two scripts, and I loved in the second script, I felt like almost the first script for me felt like a prologue, and the second script for me almost then was like, okay, now this is the first chapter of the book, you know, where Loki goes. And I loved that it was like a mystery and it was like a detective story. And I remember I was saying to them, oh, we should make this like film noir. Like, that would be so cool to me. And also because I was dealing with in my head, I was like, okay, well, the TVA is outside of time and space. There's no sun. There's no sunlight. How do I show this place? And obviously I went to the comics and took a lot of inspiration from there visually as well. And then working with my production designer in Autumn, obviously. But I think something me and Autumn really connected on is that, yeah, we love like the same lighting. And I think because also the variant was always attacking from shadow, right? And for me, I was like, oh, that's such like a detective story. So yeah, so there's Seven, but loads of film noir and like that, loads right. of stuff we were pulling from. But yeah, but that was definitely one that we just kept coming back to. And then obviously when you've got a character in a library, like I was like, oh, well, we have to like do an homage to that scene. I think because honestly, I just love Fincher. I think he's a genius. And yeah, and I was like, okay, well, Maybe he won't mind me doing a little nod to his story.
I had a listener point that out to me, that the credits were very Seven as well.
Yeah, I think because basically we also had like Kazza and his team. We just had so much beautiful stuff that we couldn't all get into the show. And like even like and it felt like, okay, and also because we're building this whole new corner of the MCU, right, with the TVA. And it felt again like, okay, well, the credits are another chance for us to do some fun world building and kind of just, you know, show more of this beautiful tech that, you know, our team had made. So, yeah, and definitely Seven. And I think it was just fun for us to kind of lean into that a little bit. And, yeah, and just, again, show off. And, like, there's pictures that change each time we do the credits. I'm sure people have noticed that. And, Yeah, but it was just really fun, I think, in that sense. And just the kind of, like, the style, like, even, like, the way, cause I think because the Rolling Loki title had been established before I joined, but we shifted it slightly to that more black and white color and that kind of effect. Because for me, anyway, I was like, again, I think it was really just the film noir influence. I just, I just was like, oh, I think that really, like, gives it, you know, the sense of identity that we're going for here, but also keeps the interesting thematic idea of, you know, Loki's always changing. He's not one thing in the sense of the letters moving. So
one more thing about this sort of religious good versus evil thing. Something sure. that Wonmi said that I thought was so interesting is she said, can we even be held accountable for our actions if there is some sort of hand guiding the timeline or something like that? Then what, and we haven't been able to make these choices for ourselves. How can we then be called good or evil if someone else is sort of guiding those choices for us? And I was wondering, like, what you can say about that.
It's definitely an interesting discussion, isn't it? Because I think Loki within himself, right, people always talk about his actions within Avengers, and they're like, oh, but, you know, he was under the influence. So, like, but I think I'd say, that's interesting. And just thinking of a good answer. Like, I guess that plays into it, right? Is like, if someone does something that's greatly evil, it's like, to what end? And if someone does great evil, right, like, I guess if someone was completely without empathy, that it's almost like a way to remove yourself from the situation, right? Which I think all our characters have a lot of, you know, they might not always make the best choices, but, you know, in our Loki, for example, Tom's Loki, we see there's empathy there, there's regret there. Even when he talks at the end of the first episode, he's like, I did it because I had to. So I think for me, yeah, I mean, there has to be some element of choice in that, right? Like, but obviously the overarching plan is that, yeah, like Loki, like, he was meant to be arrested, but he didn't do that. So that took him off his path. I guess the question will come more down to, like, how big does the action have to be to take you off your path? But anyway, I'm going off on a tangent now.
Right. No, I mean, that's an interesting thing because, like, obviously if variants exist, there have to be some paths that are woven back into the sacred timeline. You know what I mean? It's not like, yeah, it's not like every branch is pruned. Some branches are sort of have such minimal managed growth. Yeah. Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. That helps clarify something for me. Okay. So you mentioned the big, like, research aspect of episode two. And so I know you're a Buffy fan, you know, I'm a Buffy mm-hmm. fan. So of course that makes me think of, like, so many Buffy episodes are spent, like, poring over books with engravings and all that sort of stuff. How influential is Buffy Vampire Slayer across your work here? Like, in what way are you thinking about that show?
That's so interesting. Do you know what? I think I wasn't consciously thinking about it, but I saw it when I was, like, so young, and it's definitely a show where, like, you know, I suppose, like our show, like, it's weekly. And, you know, it would always keep me coming back to want to watch the next week. I liked all the characters. And again, like, some of the characters in that are very, like, morally, like, Faith. I love Faith. But is she a good guy or bad guy? That definitely jumps between both those places. And
yeah.
And I think for me, yeah, there's definitely a crossover, I would say. But it wasn't sort of a reference. I suppose it's a funny thing, right, as a filmmaker. Like, I definitely have some references that obviously people can just see on the surface when they watch this show, like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or Brazil or Blade Runner, whereas, like, there must be some that from a film I saw, a TV show I watched a very long time ago, you know, that I may not even consciously right. be aware of. I mean, I saw, like, I read your Easter egg document and you were talking about Lost in the first bit, and, like, I'm a massive fan of it and so is Michael, but I was like, maybe subconsciously somewhere that was a reference. I mean, I was referencing Iron Man with that scene,
right.
but yeah, but I was like, but it might have played into it, though. Do you know what I mean? Because I love that show. So I know. But that's... I would say probably Buffy is somewhere in the DNA of the show just because I love it. So
a bunch of people were asking if the Randy character in episode 2 was a Buffy reference, a reference to Tabula Rasa and Randy Giles. And I was like, well, maybe, I don't know. But
I don't know. Because yeah, his character name was written in by Alyssa, the writer. So he would be the person I would say, readers, to ask that question. So it might have been intentional from her.
But that's the thing about an Easter egg hunt. And you don't want to get like too bogged down in like what Easter eggs are there, what references are there. Thematically is more interesting to me, like the what you're talking about, 7 and stuff like that. Like the music cue is interesting, but then thematically that's even more interesting to me. And yeah, when you do an Easter egg hunt, obviously sometimes you pick up the wrong thing. I saw your Iron Man post. I was like, yeah, no. That's a better reference, of course.
No,
of course, but... is that, you know what I mean? Yeah.
I don't think it's wrong, though, because, like, there's stuff that people pick up in the show and, you know, some of it is intentional, some of it might not have been intentional. But I kind of just think, like, when you make anything, like, it's yours, right? Like, while you're cooking away in it and building it. And then once it's out in the world, I think it's, like, the audience's. So, no, I'm always excited by different reads people have on it. I love that you thought it was like Lost. I was like, that's so cool. So no, I'm genuinely just excited. I'm trying to now each week maybe just give a little bit more, like, kind of, to be honest, the kind of thing you'd hear on a director's commentary, more like making of kind of stuff. But I try not to give too many Easter egg stuff away, because I think for me, as someone that loves hunting for them, I think it kind of gives away a bit of the fun, right? So yeah, and I read stuff online that people theorize and think about it, and I think it's really cool. But
Well, then let's talk about some of the making of stuff. You know, one question one of my listeners had was like, how was any of this episode 3 shot in the volume that Marvel and sort of Lucasfilm have been using, or was it shot differently?
In my head, I was like, the bubble. Like my very stupid technical way of talking about it. No, we didn't use that. So actually we filmed, we filmed most of it on the back lot of the studio. We filmed outside for lighting reasons, because it was like, you know, autumn was like, oh, actually, I think it's better if we are outside for it, because of the kind of palette of the sky we were going for and how we could control the light. Mm-hmm. So no, we filmed it all. It was very old school. Old school in a sense. Like, you know, we filmed it surrounded by lots of blue screen, and then Kazra, my production designer, built certain aspects. So like the mining town, for example, obviously that shack they go up to where they fix the light, we had that. And then he designed and built this whole like kind of amazing, like kind of ghost town that they walk through. But on the day, obviously what you're working with the actors is you have almost like flags in this dirt and soil, and a few practical elements that you can put foreground, because I think that always helps sell the reality. But the actors are acting off a lot of flags. And then I obviously have the amazing artwork from our team to be like, this is what you're actually going to be walking through. We also storyboarded, like, I think I did storyboards for like 99% of the show. Like the whole thing is nearly storyboarded, basically because I love storyboarding. and I should say I worked with a storyboard artist called Martin Mercer. And then there was a few other people that worked on certain sequences across the show along with Martin. So some of it's just practical, right? Like you have to storyboard, like for example, Sharu, the big finale wanna. Like we boarded that to a certain extent, but really we ended up doing a previs on that, which is basically, for anyone that doesn't know, it's essentially like a, almost like The Sims, and it's like a run through with these like virtual sim versions of your actors, and they use the set design to scale and actors obviously, and that's what you kind of use as a basis for working out some camera moves, and then visual effects can use that to see, okay, well, this is where the practical set ends and then we begin. So it's kind of a way for your whole team to kind of put all your brains together and be like, how do we execute this? But Sharu, no, like that was a massive set that Kazra built, that whole, like all the buildings obviously stopped above a certain height, but that was real. We didn't film in the volume. I'd love to. I haven't filmed in that before, so it'd be cool.
The production design is incredible on this show. Just so incredible. The design of the TVA and the design of this planet is just amazing. I love it. It's not like anything we've seen in the MCU before, and I think, which is exactly your prompt, right? Develop a new corner of the MCU that we've never seen before, and exactly fulfilled. I want to talk to you about that wonder. Obviously, you brought up Children of Men earlier, and like, was that, did Bishop put that in the script where she's like, and then it ends on this long one-er, and then you're like, oh, great. Or how did that come about?
Yeah, so basically the one-er wasn't in the script, but I think the thing that was really key in Bish's writing that I thought was so fantastic is that when you were reading it, you really feel like you're with them. And I remember that she had this amazing description of the planet cracking. And she had, I don't want to get this wrong, so I'm sorry, Bishop, if I misremember it, but she had this description of like a whole city falling silent. And I just was so taken by that. And I was like, oh man, that's so cool. But I think the real beautiful thing in her writing, though, is that you really felt you were worried about them and you really felt for them. And I think from that, I was really inspired. And then me and Autumn took that and then turned that into, you know, the what we see on screen today. So it was basically taking what we had in the script from Bisha and then adapting that to work within, you know, the set that we had from Kazra. But I think that for me, I was just, the one that came out of the writing, honestly. I just read what she had written and was like, oh, this is so cool. Because like I said, like, you know, at the train station, it's fun. They're coming up with a plan and they're trying to sneak on a train. And it's kind of not Pompeii, but your POVs with the Lokis, and you're kind of like working out, how do these two characters, like, are they going to trust each other? Are they not going to trust each other? So that's what I loved about Sharu, was that it's the first time they're really working as a team well, but it's also in these horrific circumstances. And it's also the first time as an audience, I felt we had to be along with them for the ride, because it not only gives you insight into Sylvie, because she's been hiding in these apocalyptic situations, but also, I think importantly, it shows, you know, it's horrific. This is a horrific scenario they're in, and they're not the only characters being affected by this. Obviously, we've seen this kind of rising, you know, uprising by the people that work on the planet against the oppressive kind of, you know, I guess like almost like police force that are on the planet. So I think that it was really trying to take those elements and put people into the throes of a horrible apocalyptic situation. Yeah, and that's why I think for me the one-er felt right, because I wanted to. Obviously, me and Autumn, I'm sure people have noticed we love doing long takes, but I think for us both, it was just like our North Star of like wanting to honor Fisher's awesome writing. But also for me, like, I knew I wanted to get one in the story somewhere, but I think it always has to be led by what's right for the story rather than just, oh, let's just do a one. You know what I mean? So I think that felt like, just seeing what the intent was, I was like, okay, this definitely feels like the right way to approach this sequence.
What can you tell me about the Asgardian song that finds its way into this episode?
The Asgardian song was a Michael pitch that came in, I think, later. And I was like, oh, so funny and so lovely. And I think it's nice, you know, it's a little win for Loki. He has a nice time on the train. He has a song. And I think we haven't seen Loki like this before. And I think that to me was really interesting. And yeah, and it was specially written for us. Like, it isn't a song we adapted, and Tom learnt the lyrics, obviously, and the language. And yeah, but I think it was just nice again to just see Loki having, you know, a nice time in, obviously, a complete Loki fashion with the backdrop of an apocalypse. You know? So, yeah.
Something that Winnie also said to me was that I was asking her about reshoots, like if you guys did a lot of reshoots, because Marvel mm-hmm. builds in, right, like a window to do reshoots. And she said no, and one of the reasons she thought was because of the COVID pause, there was a lot of like reworking of scripts that was like able to happen, refining and stuff like that. So I was wondering, like, if you could talk about like sort of how much work was done to tweak or change or tighten or whatever, and mm-hmm. the nature of it in that pause.
Yeah, sure. So I think the thing was, like, coming into it, like already before COVID, right? So Michael had done his writer's room, and then I joined the project, and we did, I guess you could call it, like, I mean, like a mini room at best. It was like me, Michael, Eric, and Alyssa, and Kevin Wright, our executive from Marvel. And then again, we were kind of working with the scripts, and that was really like, I guess, things I was bringing in, but also just the practicality of like, this is awesome, but this is kind of how we could execute it, you know, like that is for an example. So we did a lot of work on the scripts already up to the point of shooting. But I would say really what the gap gave us, which I think is so interesting, is that, you know, normally you don't always know completely what you obviously have an idea of what you're making, but you don't really know until you're in the edit. And I think the good thing about, so when we obviously couldn't film anymore, I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to cut everything we filmed with my editors and try out lots of different, because I didn't have a composer then either, like temp music, and just really key in on the tone of the show and see, like, you know, what's singing, what's not singing, what are cool little nuances that the actors are doing that maybe on the day we might not see, but, you know, as you craft the, you know, character with their wonderful performance, you start to notice those things. So I think really, like, for us, that was definitely helpful in the sense that we kind of got, I got a handle on like where the story was going. And then with Eric, like our production writer, like me, him and Kevin, like we would talk a lot about, like, you know, just like, oh, let's try and push it this way or this way. And I think something else that came out of it, just because obviously it was COVID, there were certain scenes, for example, that we couldn't have a lot of background. So like one that could be non-spoilery would be episode one, when Loki goes through the TVA and it's the DMV style. And that room originally with Miss Minutes, there was a huge queue of people there. Right. But obviously we couldn't do that because it wasn't safe. But then it actually, I think, ended up working out better for story because, you know, it's almost more ridiculous. He's going into a room with all these turnstiles and this huge queue, and he's like, this doesn't make any sense. But I think in a way that kind of really played into the kind of, you know, fish out of water story that he's going through, but also just our own frustrations, I'm sure, like going to ridiculous bureaucratic kind of situations, or even just something simple like trying to go for an airport security system. So I think we tried to make, obviously, it all work for story and we keep within the tone. But yeah, we definitely worked a lot on different characters. And I think that did play into the fact that, yeah, our auditional was very minimal. Like we kind of went in with a very targeted plan. And that's also partly why, because I love storyboarding, but obviously I had to board all these scenes because I was making, obviously, our background look like much more people than were there sometimes. And I was sort of using tricks that I did in my short films where I, you know, couldn't get like a huge amount of people for a party scene, for example, but I would have, okay, well, I'll film it, I'll frame it like this and have them cross camera, and, you know, we can reuse, or we'll find ways to make it feel busy and thriving still. So yeah, I think that was a really big thing for us. And like I said, I was trying out this different music. But over the break, I was like, okay, well, let's get a composer on because that would be really helpful. And then obviously the amazing Natalie Holt joins us. Yeah. And yeah, and it was great because I think both of us were in love with the idea of theremin, because I had like, it's actually in episode two, but there's a track by Clara Rockmore, which plays in Renslayer's office. And that was in like my playlist when I pitched. And I kind of always felt like, oh, I'd love to bring that in somehow. And it felt just right to me in terms of, because I wanted it to be this big love letter to sci-fi. But when Natalie pitched, she also, like, we hadn't discussed it, but she also had this amazing theremin. And I was like, oh, I was like, she's the one. She also loves the theremin. And I think her music just, I don't know. I always feel like the dream collaborator for me, right, is that they bring it becomes a character of its own, right? Like, so Kazra's sets are such a character across the whole show. Autumn's lighting. I mean, she even talks about it. Like, she thinks of lighting as a character and camera as a character. And I think it was the same for Natalie's music. Like, she was sending me these like melancholic, but also like these kind of playful kind of like, you know, bits of music to play with. And it felt so low-key. And I think for me, like having that music then to cut in with what we had from the show, it even just led to ideas. Like as I was, you know, storyboarding sequences, I would be sometimes listening to her music because I don't know, I'm quite musical. So I would like listen to the music and be like, oh, cool, I could move the camera like this or do this. And yeah, so I think it was definitely amazing to have got her on during that time. And like I said, just everyone, we already had like a really good set of scripts and story, but I think it was just adapting it so we could film it in safe conditions. But then again, like with what we'd found through already what we filmed, just how do we tell the best version of this story and how can we keep adapting and keep evolving it? I think honestly, it was just trying to make best use of the time, really. Because
relatable content. That's so funny. Speaking of like erroneous Easter egg hunts, I Shazammed that theremin track and I was like, what is this? How has this been used? But now I know it's a Kate Herron special. It's a Kate Easter egg. That's so funny. I want to ask you, I don't know what you can say about this, but Tara Strong, in giving an interview, gave this interview to THR about Miss Minutes, and she's like, you know, keep your eye on her, there's a lot to come, blah blah. And And that's got people like really wound up and excited. So I'm just wondering like how much, like what, how much is that like a great actor just being like excited about their part? And how much should we really just be like zeroing in on Miss Minutes?
I would say honestly, just that I think Miss Minutes is a really fun character. Like I remember in the first episode, she originally came out of that TV monitor, but I just think, and I filmed it, but it's just when I was editing, I was like, no, it's too crazy. Cause like the whole, we'd already made like the TVA in itself is like, there's a lot to like suspend your disbelief for. And I think that's why I was like, okay, let's keep her in the monitor and we'll bring her out in episode two. But which felt better in the sense that, you know, she's this living cartoon, which was really fun. But yeah, I would probably say, I mean, she's part of our main TVA cast, you know what I mean? Like all our characters. So like, you know, I think the exciting thing with her character really is just, I would say, yeah, there's more to explore with her, like all the characters at the TVA, because as people hear in episode three, you know, they don't know that that's where they're from. Where Miss Minutes is from, I don't know what that would mean. But right. Yeah, but I would say, yeah, I think she's a great character, but I would say maybe not so much like laser focus in on her. I'd say it's more just across all our TVA characters, you know.
Gotcha.
What do they know of the TVA? So
I saw your lovely Instagram post about Loki's bisexuality, and Tom had already told me that this was something that was important to you early on and important to him. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just wondering like what you can say about like your discussions about how you wanted to work that into the script and make sure that it was in there and all of that. I know you're proud of it, and I think a lot of people are really happy to see it. So I'm glad it's in there.
Yeah. So I think for me, it was just about acknowledging it, because obviously it's part of who I am, and like, so I wanted to talk about it. But I think really for us, even beyond just me wanting it, it was something the whole team were like really passionate about. And Tom has always been, you know, very passionate about that. And I think it was just about doing it in the right way. And like I kind of said in my post, like it's a small step, because, you know, he's just talking about it. But at the same time, it's a very big step, because, you know, I saw some people being like, well, actually for me, this is a massive step for like where I'm from. So I think I was very touched by that. But yeah, I think for us, it was just really important to just sort of like, if anyone asked me, right, I would just be very matter of fact. And I think that was important. And I thought it was written very beautifully by the writers. And yeah, I'm very happy that we have it in there. And because, you know, in, across the comics, like, you know, he's been written as bi, he's been written as pan. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was important for us to just, I just wanted to bring that to the MCU canon.
Happy Pride. Well, thank you, Kate Herron, for chatting with me for so long. I really appreciate you
thank you.
And it was a joy for me. And and keep catching up on your sleep as best you can. And
hopefully the interviews will slowly improve as I get more sleep.
No, you're great. You're great. And hopefully I'll get to talk to you again before this is all over.
Yeah, it'd be great. Yeah, I'm really excited to do interviews once the whole show is out, right. And I can be like, I can now talk about it.
So, answer any question and not have to think about what am I spoiling? Yeah, totally.
Exactly.
All right, we are back. Do you want to, where do you want to start? Do you want to start with vampires? Do you want to start with my all Lokis or Lokis theory, or like Miss Minutes? Where do you want to start, Anthony?
Let's start with Miss Minutes.
Okay, so Tara Strong gave an interview last week to THR where she was just sort of saying something like, oh, you know, more is coming for Miss Minutes. And I couldn't tell if it was just like one of those things where it's like what is an actor supposed to say? Like, I'm gone for the show forever. Like, you know, of course more is coming. But a bunch of people got like kind of wound up about it. Like, oh my God, is Miss Minutes actually the like mastermind behind it all? And I asked Kate Herron, and she was just sort of, I was like, should we be laser focused on Miss Minutes? She's like, you should be focused on everyone at the TVA. So I don't know. I don't know if Miss Minutes is going to be revealed as our big bad here. I mean, we think it's Kang, but like, I don't know. What do you think could happen with Miss Minutes?
The Magic Castle has this neat trick where they have a piano player ghost, so you can stand there and, you know, it's just playing ragtime and, you know, whatever, classical songs. And the fun of that is trying to trip it up. Say like, okay, can you play a little bit of, you know, the New World Symphony by Dvorak and Britney Spears, Hit Me Baby One More Time. And then, like, it does it. So, you know, that's not pre-recorded in there. And there's a trick behind it, which I won't spoil for people, but it's pretty kind of an obvious one when you ultimately think about it. And I think that's what's going on with Miss Minutes, is that Miss Minutes seems like an automaton, but she is not. That's my guess. That she, when she is talking to Loki, that's somebody talking through her. Maybe it's Kang, you know, using a way of masking himself.
Mm.
Maybe it's somebody else. But, like, it's a way of being there, but being remote. That's my guess. What do you think?
Sure. I like it. I don't know how, like, full sinister I want Miss Minutes to go, but it could be really fun. So we're going to keep our eye on that. Also, Mobius, did you clock that Mobius lifted that pen again in Ravonna's office?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That pen. I'm excited to figure out what's going on with it.
I think that's where Kid Loki is from.
It could be. I think that's what I said before. But I, you know, what is Mobius's connection to that? Do you know? I don't know.
Maybe they were in high school.
But is Kid Loki from a Midgard high school when he's got Asgardian gear on? I don't know. Like, he's dressed like an Asgardian, is he not?
Yeah, he is. But maybe he's come to that. I don't know.
Maybe. We also get a mention of vampires. Mobius says that, like, they've pulled in Titans and vampires. And that to me, I think that's like a first mention of vampires in the MCU, which, the MCU proper, right? Which, can only, you know, be laying a brick for Blade to come. Marshall Ali's Blade is coming. Vampires are coming to the MCU. You know?
Or Morbius? Could it possibly be that?
Maybe, but that's not Marvel.
It's not Marvel Studios. I mean, it's Marvel, but it's not. But it's part of the, I guess, Spider-Man legacy. So Sony has it, but then that's kind of tangentially related. Although it's not really clear whether Venom or Morbius would be connected through Tom Holland's Spider-Man. Like, that hasn't been explicit, right?
Right now, I think they're trying to keep those.
Yeah, they're trying not to cross those streams. Yeah, so
exactly.
So that seems unlikely. That was my first thought, but you're right about Blade and Mahershala Ali. He is making that movie, or signed on to play that character. So I think that was a little bit of a lie. Yeah, don't forget about it. Blade.
Vampires are coming. Someone pointed out that A23 is Ravonna's number, just like B15, C20, etc. Avengers 23 is a comic that features Kang the Conqueror. And it's where Ravonna makes her first appearance. So I don't know if that's a nod to that.
Yeah, it's got
to
be an Easter egg, right?
Yeah.
I mean either that or a cosmic coincidence.
So. Yeah. someone else pointed out that there are runes on the throne walls, like in the throne room. That's what I'm calling it, where the animatronic timekeepers are.
Could that be why magic doesn't work?
Exactly. That's a thought, right?
Where you were going?
Yeah. This is what's blocking magic in the TVA, are these runes in the throne room.
Uh-huh. Because it definitely does not work. We saw, you know, Lady Loki trying to use it, and it's not happening. So, and of course, Loki himself can't use it. So I wonder if that's, you know, a little lesson learned from Agatha.
And who would be powerful enough to cast that? You know, that's a question I have.
Are you trying to bring us back to Mephisto?
No, never.
Back to Mephisto.
I just don't know if, like, is Kang canonically a sorcerer? Not really, you know.
No,
I mean?
He's not.
So, like, who would cast runes like that there?
And whoever cast it can still use magic within. So, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I don't know. Have we seen anybody who seems to use magic? Could it be Miss Minutes?
Could be. I would love if Miss Minutes is our warlock of our magic user of this universe, you know, is Miss Minutes.
Disguising herself as this cute little little animated clock.
It was Miss Minutes all along. I love it. The other thing, you know, you've watched the Loki trailers, right? And you know that there's like there's that shot of like Loki as like a President Loki, vote for Loki pin sort of thing, where he's sort of shrugging at the camera. Have you seen that shot?
Yes.
Okay, so someone on Twitter pointed out that all... So he's got a bunch of henchmen around him. And you kind of assume that they're just henchmen. But one of them is that Loki variant from when Mobius was, like, doing a little holograph zoom through the Loki variants. And one of them had, like, dark glasses and weird, like, a weird jumpsuit and a beard. And I was like, who is... What is that? Who is that? Like... It was such a weird moment for me because I was like, I don't know what reference we're trying to pull here. But someone on Twitter pointed out that that's one of the henchmen behind President Loki in the trailer, which could imply that all of those guys are Lokis and that, you know, what we're seeing, this pocket dimension is a dimension where Loki wins the Battle of New York. That's why Avengers Tower is decimated. That President Loki is like, that Loki, the Loki is played by Tom Hiddleston, but the Loki who won the Battle of New York, he's got a bunch of Loki henchmen. And our Lokis, our League of Lokis, our Kid Loki, our Classic Loki, all of that are going to have to like battle those Lokis to get out of wherever they are. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I think it's a good forecast for where things are going. I mean, I don't know what else to say beyond that. I will happily co-sign that theory. I think it's a good one.
The idea that Kang is behind everything does bring us back to this idea that, like, if there's a sacred timeline worth protecting, it's something that Kang needs to happen.
Yeah.
And we still don't know what that thing could be. Do you have any thoughts about that?
My theory is that disruption, I mean, chaos is where Loki thrives, right?
Yeah. And
so disruption is, maybe that's some sort of cover or a way to reignite this battle between Kang and the others. Or maybe there are no others. Like, the notion that there is a tribunal that's deciding what is the sacred timeline and what isn't, is a little bit reassuring because there's that sense of like, well, there are multiple people making a decision. It's not just trusted to one person. One person would be a dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
So what if behind the scenes, that's why there are these robots that Kang is orchestrating everything. And, you know, I don't, maybe he is ruling it all. And that's why he's weeding out these good guys, these heroes that could stand in his way. Maybe it's like a King Herod thing. Like, he's got to get rid of the good Lokis because of, you know, he's aware that they could rise up and unite and take him down. And so he's got to kill them, you know, destroy them, weed them out.
Is that like a prophecy thing? Of like, you will be killed by a Loki?
Yeah, maybe. So he has I mean, like, if there's no past, present, or future, it's out of time and space. He's going to go through and say, well, maybe, okay, the one thing that defeats me is these Lokis, so let's get rid of them all.
Self-fulfilling prophecy, man.
Or keep them focused fighting elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. The idea that, like, the TVA exists possibly in the quantum realm is something that we've talked about a little bit about. But that, because the quantum realm, time works differently there, et cetera.
Yeah.
Our listener Christina wrote in and said, while I'm loving this show and the themes and the great acting, this show, more than the previous two, meaning WandaVision, Falcon, Winter Soldier, seems to be the most obvious with its laying of groundwork for upcoming movies. Multiverse of Madness, No Way Home, and Quantumania. And I'm not mad at it, just if I think about it too hard, I get a bit cynical. So what do you think about these, like, Disney Plus shows as, like, the balance between them being their own thing and laying track for future films, etc.?
That's always the struggle, right? Is that does the thing stand enough on its own, or is it being used to prop up as a prologue to future storytelling? And I have to say, I agree. I think there's a lot of foundation laying happening here, but it's kind of like one of those HGTV shows where it's about laying foundations. So this is about establishing the rules of a multiverse. and they've taken a character who's unsettled, who died and we miss, and brought him back and threw him into this, sort it out. So I think this is definitely the kind of stories they're telling, and multiverse is a concept that DC has embraced, and it's really popular because what it does is, I think, and I've written about this for a story that's coming up soon in the print edition of Vanity Fair, fan bases are unruly right now, and everybody has their own version of what they like, what they don't like. And multiverse is a way to give everybody everything. You can have kid-friendly versions of the characters. You can have grim, dark versions of the characters. You can have mainstream, you know, funny action versions of the characters. And maintain that fan base by saying they're all legitimate because they all interact and all exist in the same universe. And so I think this is just, I think it's breaking ground, not just for future Marvel storytelling, but just establishing a kind of new cinematic language where these characters last for a long time and they exist within us. Like we watch them, we consume them. That's the multiverse. All the James Bonds that we like, we can debate who's the best, but they don't really connect except that we know them. The audience knows them. They exist in the audience's subconscious together. Otherwise, they're all separate. So I think this is kind of a new approach that comic book fans are well aware of, but a new cinematic approach that says, okay, it's not just that we've cast a new Batman and now it's a new bunch of stories, but we're going to say that all of those ones are valid too, and they all interact. They're all part of the same continuum. So, yeah, I think that's kind of... Sorry if that's a long answer.
No,
that's
good.
I think Loki's going.
Yeah, I mean, this idea, like, when we see this League of Lokis show up, it's very, you know, especially since there's, like, a little alligator, crocodile, lizard Loki over here, right? Like, that can't help but make us think of the Spider-Verse, right? Like,
Yep.
With Spider-Ham.
Spider-Ham.
And all of that. So, and it has prompted some folks to ask, you know, there's been these rumors. It's not confirmed, but there's all these rumors that Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield are going to show up in the next live-action Spider-Man film. And so someone was like, could they just be variant? Like, are they variants? Like, is that what we're going to see? Like, we're going to see spider variants.
Yeah, I think they are.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they would be if that.
Yeah, if that happens. So, like, you know, and that's a way in which this is setting up No Way Home, Multiverse of Madness, Quantum. If the TVA is in the quantum realm, Quantumania, like all its, you know, Kang, everything. So it's just it is interesting to think about these shows in that light. It is what the MCU has always done, and sometimes it's out of whack, and sometimes it feels seamless. So, you know, there you go.
You know, and also, people who read my work know I'm really interested in the writings of Stephen King, and he did this with the Dark Tower series.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny because, like, he would drop these little Easter eggs into his stories, little references to Cujo or a little reference to the Dead Zone. And then he would have a book like The Stand that ends the whole world. But that, okay, well, that can't exist in the little universe he's created, right? Because the world clearly didn't end in these other books. And the ones that came after. And yet he found a way to make it all fit together because all of these different realities exist within the Dark Tower. The Dark Tower is this nexus point between different dimensions and worlds. And, like, that's kind of a cool idea. And I think, I don't know if I would say he came up with it, the idea of a multiverse. But, you know, King and comic books, like, they all kind of, it's sort of like how, the radio and the light bulb was kind of, it was like a race to see who's going to invent it first, you know, like everybody's got a society is moving toward it and it's just going to eventually happen. And I think that's where we are in cinematic storytelling is, oh, we like this idea that we can have different flavors of the same character.
Josh wrote in this question where he says, the show has all these mysteries, right? Who made the TVA? Why kidnap variants to do your grunt work? What outcome is the TVA and their creator attempting to steer the timeline towards? Why are Loki variants so important to the TVA? Given that the show has these mysteries, are there answers that would insufficiently satisfy so as to totally taint the overall show, even without rampant fan speculation to heighten expectations, the show is writing some checks that I'm not super confident that it will be able to cash. It feels like disappointment is some ways inevitable with things like this. So, I don't know.
I love the writing. I love our listeners and their eloquent letters. Like, that's so beautifully put. The show is writing checks that it cannot cash. That's funny. Yeah, I think that's always the problem with Marvel, is that it creates a lot of speculation in the mind of the viewers like us, but then it ultimately has to satisfy the much broader audience of casual fans,
mm-hmm.
who just want the action and the jokes and a little bit of sci-fi and a little bit of mystery, but to have it be resolved in a way that's not going to necessitate them going to the appendix, you know, or the index or the glossary. And so, I always advocate it's fun to speculate, but I think it's important to remember that Marvel is always going to keep it pretty understandable. And that doesn't always satisfy the people who want the elaborate gargantuan theories, the big brain theories.
Right. And like, I have learned in my years of theorizing that, like, you got to let go of those theories. You got to hold them loosely in your hands and be ready to let go of them as soon as the tide turns. Do you know what I mean? If only for your own enjoyment. Sometimes I do find myself like writing a version of the show that maybe I would prefer to watch, you know, out of hubris or whatever, but like that's only going to impede my own enjoyment of the show. And it's just something that I need to learn to like, and I think have learned to just sort of like, as soon as they walk into the, I'll say this. As soon as it saw Richard E. Grant in his yellow diaper, I was like, well, I guess he's not the mastermind behind the TVA. And I just sort of let it go, let it float down the stream. You know what I mean? It's fine. Is there a way it could unsatisfactorily resolve? Absolutely. Of course it could. Like, mm-hmm. I think, you know, some of the Sharon Carter power broker stuff, even though we saw that coming, like, did not feel like a satisfactory end to that series. So, you know, it's like, yeah, it could drop the ball for sure. But, you know, so far I'm enjoying it.
So far I'm enjoying it too. So I'm like, I just think it's going to resolve itself in a way that simplifies rather than becomes. Mind-blowing,
you know. Yeah. All right, we got this email from Rebecca that I really love, that's sort of about Loki's nature in the original Norse mythology. And she writes, Loki is a trickster, and tricksters traditionally are gods of both destruction and creation. The only reason that Loki is so often portrayed as satanic in Norse mythology is because those written records are from monks. They needed Ragnarok to symbolize the coming of the Christian god, and Loki is the Satan analog who brought it about. But based on everything we know about tricksters in all mythologies, Loki is probably not a villain in his original mythological form. Just another trickster like Raven and Coyote and Eshu and Hermes and Monkey and Prometheus, screwing around with the taboos and being agents of chaos and change, messing with humans for their own hedonistic delight, but also siding with them against other gods. I don't know how any of this relates to the comics, and I don't know how deliberate this is in the showrunner's part, but I do think that given this context, the heavy emphasis on Loki as an agent of death and destruction in episode 1 is setting him up for a shift in his hopefully less burdensome, glorious purpose. How perfect would it be if his new purpose is change? And how wonderful if he ends the show on an act of creation, of unleashing the multiverse of madness. Again, I don't know how deeply the showrunners went into their Joseph Campbell, but it would be incredibly satisfying for me as a viewer if Loki embraced his role as a true god of mischief. Thank you all for the podcast. Thanks, Rebecca. I mean, I do think it goes back to like that Kid Loki comic we were reading, which was such an interesting comic, the one that Michael Waldron had writer recommended, which is about, you know, Loki gets reincarnated as Kid Loki. He's still Loki, but he's kind of trying to be someone new, and he's trying to be good, and or at least sort of in common cause with his brother and stuff like that. And there's all these people telling him that he's bad, like the cycle with Lady Sif in this episode. That happens again and again in that comic with like the other warriors, you know, that they're just sort of like, Loki, he's a liar. Loki, he's a villain. Loki, he's a this, blah, blah, blah. Whereas this kid is just like kind of trying to be something else. And, you know, that's where Waldron said was so interesting to him, not just because there is a literal kid Loki in this TV series we now know, but because that Loki of, like, do I have to be what you think I am? Do I have to be a villain? Mobius has a similar line earlier in the season when he talks about, like, you know, change. It's in the opening jingle that Dave wrote for this podcast. You know what I mean? Like, this idea of change. Can he change? Can he be the hero just for one day, as you say? Like, and so I love this idea that, like, Loki has been cast for hundreds of years as a villain when this idea of being in common cause with humans against the gods, a la Prometheus, is so interesting to me. So, I don't know. I'm excited.
I like it, and I'll plagiarize myself a little and say that I think there are, I really believe this, and I've written this before, like, that people who are told that they are unworthy of love start to believe it, especially when they're told at a young age. And it makes them lash out, makes them sabotage things that are good for them, relationships that are healthy. When somebody shows you kindness or shows you love and you think you don't deserve it, you really believe you don't deserve it because it's been beaten into you. You sabotage, you undermine it, you do the thing to push the person away. Even if you kind of want that relationship or you want that kindness, you almost can't help it. Because if that's what you deserve, then everything you believe is wrong. But everything you believe is about how bad you are. And I think it creates a kind of dissonance, and I think it leads to a lot of self-destructive behavior. And if that's not Loki, I don't know what is.
Love it. Maureen wrote in and asked, do we think the gator / croc / lizard Loki talks? Do we want it to talk? What do you think?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a good question. I think he communicates non-verbally, kind of like Groot. Groot just says Groot, but, like, you kind of pick up what he's putting down anyway. I think there has to be another way for a reptile Loki to communicate. If he's going to just be chatting away and we're going to animate the lips of this alligator, I don't know that that would work for me so well.
My hope is that he can talk, but only Kid Loki can understand him, so he can, like, have a conversation with him.
Yeah.
That we can only hear one side of. Yeah. That would be really fun. Yeah, I guess there's also this, people keep coming up with these Infinity Stone theories, and I just have to say, the way I feel about the Infinity Stones is that they really only exist in this series to show the TVA's power. And I don't love the idea. You know, people thought maybe Loki had palmed one. People thought maybe, like, the Infinity Stones had been sort of zapped into one of the pocket dimensions, etc. I don't think that that's the case. That's a call I'm going to make.
I agree with you. I think the reason that we see the Infinity Stones in the junk drawer is that this show is telling us we're not using these as a device.
We're not in Kansas anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they've done it, so it's like, okay, yeah, these don't work here. Everybody cool? All right, moving on.
Do you have anything else you want to say about Renslayer, Ravonna?
I mean, I think she's pretty bad. I think if we don't get Kang the Conqueror necessarily, I think she's turning out to be the villain of the story.
I mean, she could be. Like, this could be like with Agatha, where we were, like, looking for the bigger villain, and it was just like, no, it's Catherine Hahn. It's like, no, it's Gugu Mbatha-Raw, which, like, wouldn't be, you know. I think because we see her as, like, having moved up the ranks, that's why I think she's not the ultimate villain, unless she killed the original Timekeepers.
Maybe.
Once upon a time. And replace them with robots and just carried on business as usual. But
her character had a thing with Kang the Conqueror.
Didn't yeah. It? Yeah. So. Yes. Absolutely. I'm just saying.
Like, I'm sensitive to this notion that, like, oh, does there have to be a bigger villain behind her? Not necessarily. I think there's always a bigger villain in Marvel lore. There's always another villain who's going to cause problems the next time. And I could see, you know, Kang being sort of a background figure while she becomes the main bad guy.
I just have questions about how much they're going to give us Kang in this series.
Not much. I don't think much.
You know.
But I think like a tease.
Yeah, so I think I'm gonna read this last email is from your variant, Anthony L. who wrote in, he called himself that in the email. He wrote in, please talk about the apocalypses themselves and connect them to the plot and character development discussions. Loki stands out as a show that foregrounds climate catastrophe and the politics of escape in an important way. First the Alabama storm, then the Snowpiercer-ish train in episode 3, where Loki sings about glaciers. Only the rich are getting tickets, right? And then the Ark of the Rich is destroyed. Maybe Anthony B. would be more interested in episode 3 if he considered the apocalypses as more than background to a personal narrative. Would love to hear your you consider these issues before the series ends. And so, like, Kate talked about this a bit in the interview that we aired earlier about, like, what their intentions were for the apocalypses. That, like, when we first see Pompeii, it's kind of just a joke. Loki's certainly treating it as a joke. It's just sort of like, oh, ha-ha, Pompeii sort of thing. Then you get a rock star.
You're not going to get canceled for that being too soon, you know? Like, there's nobody saying, like, hey, man, my great.
Mobius is trying. He's like, have some decency here, man. But then we get the rocks cart apocalypse, and we get a little bit more. Like, we get Mobius talking about, like, his empathy for these victims, like, that they have a lot to fear, but, like, let's not be the thing that they fear sort of thing, mm-hmm. right? And then you get to this episode 3, that apocalypse, and like I kind of agree with you. Like, you were like, this apocalypse isn't really touching me in the way that I think they want it to. And I think you were right, because listening to Kate talk about it, she was like, you should be really, these should be escalating experiences with apocalypses, and we should be in an apocalypse where in episode 3 where you're just like really feeling the full scale dramatic trauma of this. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of agree with Anthony Breskin that I'm like, I'm not sure I really did feel it the way that they wanted me to in episode 3. But I do think it's interesting that,
it's like, oh, this gravel world is going to be destroyed. Like, what a tragedy.
Well, I mean,
but there are people who, you know, there are human beings there, but they're not given a moment where you actually empathize with them. They're just sort of background.
Yeah. I think I needed a little bit more, information about the stakes of it. Like, maybe I would have liked the episode more. Maybe this wouldn't have felt very Loki. Maybe I would have liked the episode more if the Lokis were trying to save the people or something like that, rather than just.
Oh, I think you're right. I think that's what it actually needed was, because I would have had a question then. Is, obviously, the Lokis are going to make it, but are they going to succeed in helping these people who, you know, create a character? A mother is a compelling character. There was a woman who was like, oh, wasn't there a woman sort of jeering them, like, oh, the rich are getting on this train. Like, it'd be nice if they were going to sneak on and they figured out a way, like, well, let's take a couple of other people with me. Maybe then they'll be all right, you know? And wanting to succeed at that and also not succeeding. In the end, maybe they get pulled through the portals and the friends that they're trying to save don't.
Yeah,
and you know, the TVA says it doesn't matter. You know, we don't.
Once again,
have
we're writing the show that we'd like to see rather than the show.
I guess. Yeah. But I'm just saying. I think you know, I'm just trying to use an example of like how I think that could have raised the stakes a little bit more. Like if they, again, it goes back to the thing you and I keep saying, and I've already said once in this episode, like, give the heroes of Marvel someone to care about, and the amount you care for them as an audience member goes up. So if there's somebody they're trying to help, and we care about that person too, suddenly that relationship and the character building that that this plot is allowing, the plot that's allowing the character development to dangle off of it, is much more interesting.
I can only think that, like, the reason these apocalypses, apocali, whatever, are recurring. Like, I have to wonder if it all does tie back to Ragnarok, right? Because, like, are we building towards something? Like, is the thing that's worth protecting the fact that Ragnarok happens? Does Kang need Ragnarok to happen for some reason? Because, like, you know, would these more, like, if you want to interpret it as, like, Loki brought around about Ragnarok, which you kind of could, because he definitely contributes to Odin's death. you know what I mean? And Odin dying is why Hela is there and all this sort of stuff like that. If you want to blame Loki, you can. It's not hard to. But, like, it, you know, with these more heroic versions of Loki, the Sylvie or boastful Loki or whoever, would they have averted Ragnarok? And in doing so, would that foil something in Kang's plan? I don't know. But it feels like the apocalypse thing, if it would be satisfying to me if it were building towards something more than what we've seen so far. Do you know?
Yeah, I think that would be satisfying, too. I think that would be, you know, much more interesting and compelling.
All right, so fingers crossed for Ragnarok. Anyway, I think we did it. I think
it brings it home. It brings it home, too, right? You can go back to Asgard.
I think that's episode 4 for us. Please do continue to email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We've got the great Gugu Mbatha-Raw, I believe, on the podcast next week, if all goes according to plan. So if you have any questions for her, you can send them my way, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Until next week, where we may or may not have a Parisian variant of Richard on the podcast. Anthony Breskin, where can folks find you?
You can find me over at vanityfair.com, and reiterating to every person I meet on the street that we care about Marvel characters because they care about other people.
You can find me on vanityfair.com. You follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, and I'm excited for what we're going to find out from classic Loki. I mean, if the rest of the series is just Richard E. Grant, you know, run in the joint, up. I will have no problems with it. So here we go. We'll see you all next week.
Bye.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.